This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, Prime Minister Tony Blair of the UK offers an olive branch to the axis of evil, and major shakeups at the Washington Post, the LA Times, and Philadelphia Inquirer raise questions about the future of newspapers. Joining us in our New York bureau is Walter Fields, CEO and publisher of the NorthStarNetwork.com, along with Bob Meadows, writer for People Magazine. And we've got economist and author Julianne Malveaux, who is president and CEO of Last Word Productions. She's at member station WGBH in Boston, Massachusetts. Welcome, everybody, and let's go to Tony Blair. He was the one stalwart in the international community that President Bush counted on to have his back, and now he's saying, you know what, let's meet with Iran. Let's extend the olive branch. Let's try to be magnanimous. Who is this good news and bad news for, Julianne?
Well, it's good news for Iran, and it's bad news for Mr. Bush, and it's quite interesting. It's quite a turn of events. As recently as October 28th of 2005, Tony Blair had talked about a military option in Iran. But I think that in this last year of his prime ministership, this week he gave his last Queen's speech, you know, to the parliament, and he's got some 30 security-related measures that he plans to introduce in this last year of his term. And I think that he's looking at the long haul, which unfortunately Mr. Bush has been unable to do, and looking at the long haul, how much war can the planet really, you know, stand? So I don't think he's capitulating to Iran and Syria at all. I think that what he's doing instead is saying, look, guys, there are options. You can be isolated or you can come in with the rest of the world and talk about ways that we can reduce some terrorism. But it does make isolates Mr. Bush further and puts him on a limb all by himself. And that means it isolates the United States further. We cannot afford this.
Bob, in this situation, is this kind of a thumb in the eye to the Americans after Prime Minister Blair followed us around rather blindlessly, according to some of the members of his own party, the Labor Party?
I think what it really is that for Tony Blair, legacy trumps friendship. He wants to be remembered. As Julianne pointed out, this is his final year. He is now aiming for his legacy. He wants to be seen as somebody who facilitated a peace process in the Middle East, as opposed to someone who was known for merely following blindly President Bush. So I think that's really what he's working on. And honestly, this is what the American people are ready for. How can we get out of this situation? It doesn't necessarily matter how we get out. All people really want is to get out of there. And discussion, wow, what a concept. Talk to Iran and Syria. Bush is doing the same thing right now over in Asia. He's asking China and Japan and South Korea, hey, you guys, you talk to North Korea so we don't have to come in here and handle this. What a concept to get the neighbors to take responsibility for this.
Walter, let's take a look at the specifics of this partnership. Mr. Blair said that he could extend the olive branch if Iran stopped supporting terrorism in Iraq, gave up his nuclear ambitions, and he said again that Syria and Iran can choose partnership or isolation. Are those terms that Iran today, which has been, you know, pretty much ostracized by the U.S., would be willing to meet?
You know, I don't know. I think Iran has certainly made it known that it will not be bullied into a position, and I think that we have yet to really explore all of the options through diplomacy, so I think it's a good start. We need to understand that Mr. Blair is not doing this on his own. He is under tremendous pressure. His continued leadership of the UK was really a negotiated compromise because his Labour Party wanted him out. So I think, you know, what Bob suggested is exactly right, is the fact that he's trying to preserve his legacy right now. And I think he'll do anything to try to leave office on a good note. But clearly, I think most people understand that when you look at that region of the world, Iran has to be part of the solution. You cannot isolate them this early on without offering them an opportunity to be a part of a situation that allows them to have a say in how the final resolution in Iraq takes place, because you need them desperately to be on your side. So I think it's a good start, and we haven't really tested the diplomacy waters with this country yet.
Now I want to go to the people who covered the news. Yesterday we talked about the launch of Al Jazeera International. Today the topic is newspapers. A little bit more than a week ago, Dean Baquet was forced out of his position at the L.A. Times over cost cuts, a high-level African-American employee in the newspaper business. Now Leonard Downey Jr., executive editor of the Washington Post, announced shakeups that would shrink his newsroom. It's being kind of marketed as, oh, this will be great for new media, but I doubt that a lot of folks in the newsroom are kind of feeling that interpretation. And the Philadelphia Inquirer has been tightening up. There's been the whole sale and, you know, kind of disbundling of Knight Ridder, and the Tribune Company is up for sale. Should we be concerned that American newspapers as we know them just aren't going to exist anymore? Bob?
Well, they're definitely changing. Of course, the death knell for newspapers has been rung for generations now. But I think the difference now is that there was always, until you can take a laptop into the bathroom, you're always going to have newspapers. Well, you know what? You can take your little handheld anywhere you want. I spoke with a couple people at the Post, though, yesterday about this, and they're in that mode of worried but still kind of confident as to what is going to be happening, because I was in newspapers for only seven years, and I went through three of these shakeups. So this is not an extraordinary thing. This happens all the time. But really what they're getting at is the only way for newspapers to really distinguish themselves now is on the local level. National news, TV covers that in an instant, and by the time it hits the newspapers, it's done. So they really do have to focus more on the local level and, of course, on the issues that TV can't get to.
What about the economics, Julianne? I mean, a lot of these companies are profitable. They're just not as profitable as their owners want them to be.
You know, when you look at people getting a 10, 15, 20% rate of return and they say that's not enough, the question has to come up, what is enough? Because literally that was considered a respectable profit at a point in time. But the other piece of the economic equation is this. They have less advertising. You have the blogosphere. Many of the newspapers are online, and there are different kinds of models as to how you extract revenue from an online kind of model. So you are looking at some change. My concern is that when we reduce the coverage, especially of international news, to the electronic media, especially television and radio, what we end up with is a kind of shorthand that basically short circuits in-depth thinking, if you will. The minute and a half to three-minute piece that you see on a MSNBC or CNN, frankly, is no substitute for the kind of in-depth analysis that you frequently seen in newspapers. What Lynn Downey said is that people are going to have to justify now the length of their stories, and I'm not quite sure what that means, but lots of people are fearful that you're talking about sort of more McNews, more nuggets of news as opposed to news analysis, and I think that that would be a big lack. A lot of people think there are a lot of information sources out there. But the blogosphere is not reporting. It's regurgitation. It's opinion. And the issue is, where will the real reporting come? Farai, already, if we look at the coverage of the African continent, for example, it's woefully inadequate. And with these kind of cuts that you see, you can expect it to get even worse. There are all kinds of industries and other issues where there is a major inadequacy. And I don't see anyone else stepping up to fill that void.
Well, you know, Walter, you're working in online media. Is that going to take over the function?
Well, I think what we're seeing is a change not in the newspaper industry but in the media landscape. And what you're beginning to see are many papers understanding that new media has to play a role, a significant role, in the marketing of their product. And a good example to look at is the New York Times. About 3 years ago, the chairman of the New York Times gave a speech. And he basically said, the New York Times is not a newspaper company anymore. We're a media company. Right. And it doesn't matter what the distribution portal is. It could be print, it could be radio, it could be television, it could be the internet. But we're going to use all of them. So when you look at the New York Times and their partnership with the Discovery Channel, the New York Times now does incredible pieces with the Discovery Channel of investigative journalism. That's the new model that newspapers are going to start pursuing. And I don't necessarily think it's going to be a bad thing, because oftentimes when you look at today's newspapers, much of it is filler and much of it is wire service copy. There's very few papers in this country that are doing original reporting because the cost of it is so tremendous. It's the main reason why you have broadcast television networks that don't really have foreign news bureaus anymore. CNN still has probably the widest reach of any American television broadcast network, but that's been cut back years ago. So as you begin to see newspapers make the shift, and also you have to understand that the borders and barriers of news coverage have gone down. So now you do have the BBC in America providing a different perspective. You have Al Jazeera in America providing a different perspective. So I'm not too frightened about it. In fact, I'm very excited about it because I think for American citizens, you may finally get a different type of news coverage that we've never been privy to, because our news coverage has always been from the perspective of the American newsroom and a very narrow perspective. So I enjoy getting a feed from the BBC, and I've always read Al Jazeera online, so I'm looking forward to seeing their cable network if anybody will pick it up in the U.S. So I think it's a real interesting time in the media landscape.
So you're up for the pick and choose. So we'll take from that and move on to another sobering study. The Census Bureau reporting that racial disparities in income, education, and home ownership persist, and in some cases are growing between Black Americans and white households. Decades after the Civil Rights Movement, African Americans are still fighting the basic issues of how do we put food on the table? Where do we live? Are we facing things like mortgage redlining? At this point, do we need a change in strategy, Julianne?
We need a change in strategy, but we also need to enforce the civil rights laws that are on the books. And I think that government, certainly among others, have a lot to do to close some of the gaps that are a function of legacies of discrimination. There's a book out, Farai, called When Affirmative Action Was White. And it talks about all the programs that have basically transferred wealth to basically working class and middle class white folks, primarily the post-World War II period, where government subsidies allowed people to get involved in home ownership. Now, the home ownership gap, 75% of whites own their homes compared to about 49%, 50% of African Americans and Latinos. That home ownership gap is a major gap and deals with all those net worth issues. You can fund any kind of thing from starting a business to sending a child to school with home, you know, with your home equity. But African American households have by and large missed out on that boom of the 80s because of the initial inequity. Lots of folks would say, oh, get over it. It happened a long time ago. But the fact is that this is intergenerational wealth that's passed on. So that, I think, is key. And then, of course, significant discrimination remains in job markets, not only in housing markets, but and in education. And so those are things we have to deal with. I think the civil rights establishment has been relatively impotent in trying to close these kind of gaps because you're looking at micro inequities, not macro inequities.
Let's pick that up. Bob, what do you think?
I am sick and tired of studies comparing Black people to white people. You know, if we're going to race and you have a 300-yard lead, if you have a 300-year lead, the fact that I haven't caught up to you in 30 years is really not that significant to me. You know what I took from this, Farai? There was a stat that said 26 years ago, Blacks had 60% of the income of whites. Today, Blacks have 60% of the income of whites. So what I took from that is in 26 years, our income has grown at the same rate as white people. I don't want to compare myself to white people. If I'm trying to lose weight, I don't compare myself to Kobe Bryant and how he loses weight. I compare myself to how I used to be.
Can I break in for a second? Does this mean that you have resigned the Black community to living in a parallel universe economically and that it's just not going to change and that's the way it is?
Black people continue to progress. That's what I'm talking about. We continue to progress. We continue to be better than what we were. We come out with all these studies that always portray us as downtrodden and terrible and everything that, you know, it's sort of like, why are they even doing these studies anymore? They should show them to high school students. I agree with that because, yeah, they're the people who are, you know, high school students don't know anything. They go around dressed in Nazi uniforms and things like that for Halloween and think it's funny. But for the rest of us, it's like Black people continue to progress. The thing is not that I'm still trailing. The thing is that I still keep running. I still keep trying. That's what I really want Black people to take away from all this.
Bob, with all due respect, and forgive me for just jumping in for a second, the fact is that the relative issue is important. We may be progressing, and we've continued to progress, but the fact is that these gaps are widening because of issues that have been...
We're not a downtrodden people.
I'm not saying anything
people.
About downtrodden. I don't think we're downtrodden either, but I think there are gaps, and those gaps affect the material conditions under which we live and under which our children live, and we can't deny that.
All right.
I'm not denying it, and I'm sorry, Walter.
No.
It's all good. Walter, can I redirect you just a little bit to the last topic that really ties right into this, which is that stereotypes actually affect how well African Americans, Latinos, Asian Americans, Native Americans can do in the workplace, because you kind of come in with a presupposition about who you are, what your education is, how trustworthy you are. Perhaps that's one of the reasons that we are just walking along parallel lines with the white community in terms of earnings.
Well, I think it's all part of it. And if you go back to your earlier segment where you had Bill Spriggs on and you start talking about the lower tier of the labor market, I think that's where it really impacts, because when you look at hiring, that's very subjective at that lower tier. I think black men are affected by the perceptions of who they are when they go to seek a job. But I think both Julianne and Bob are making valid points this morning. I think one thing, you have to put our conditions in context and look at where we've come from. We're only 40 years out from the Civil Rights Act of 1964. So we have made tremendous progress, but we do see some gaps that are growing in certain segments of the labor market, and we should be concerned about that.
Do you think we're ever going to start moving beyond like the parallel track and start making aggressive point-by-point gains?
In time. I mean, this country is not even 300 years old. I mean, it's the other thing we have to keep in mind, if you look at the history of this country and how far we have come, it's going to take some considerable time before we start talking about equity. And I think that's something that we all need to digest. This thing may seem like it's been a long time. We're in our infancy. So I think that we still have a lot of work to do. But on the issue of federal enforcement, I think Julianne is absolutely correct. If you look at an agency like the EEOC, starting when Clarence Thomas was heading the EEOC, it's been a disaster. It hasn't enforced anything. That's an agency that we need to be looking about, because that agency can start looking at some of the discriminatory practices in the workplace. If you look at the Civil Rights Commission, that commission was almost bankrupt, broke under this presidential administration. In fact, at one point about 10 months ago, the agency couldn't pay its rent. So we need to look at those agencies that have civil rights enforcement responsibilities and make sure that they are doing their job, because at the end of the day, what we have always seen in terms of making these adjustments, these equity adjustments, it's always usually done from the perspective of either litigation or government enforcement, very rarely done on the basis of goodwill.
All right, we're going to have to let it go there. Walter Fields, CEO and publisher of the North Star Network, along with Bob Meadows of People Magazine, economist and author Julianne Malveaux. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.